We're going to be talking about fresh and local in January. And if you read the description, I tried to make it clear that we're not talking about growing in a heated hoop house. That's a whole different subject. What we're talking about is the how-to for low technology, low capital investment winter growing. That, by the way, is our strawberry field in April. We're protecting the strawberries, actually, by running the sprinklers on them. Okay, so I'm going to be talking about four basic issues for growing on the backside of the garden calendar. We're going to be talking about latitude, timing, crop and variety selection, and protection. And basically, all I have time to do here is just let you know what's significant about each of these things. But we don't have time to go into details on any of them, really. That's my wife, by the way, harvesting some greens there in that picture. So this is a picture of our farm. We are located almost smack dab in the middle of Tennessee, east, west, north, and south. We're about an hour southwest of Nashville. You can see the countryside is gently rolling. Our farm is using land that most of it's owned by my folks, and I own a little bit. And altogether, we have about 200 acres, and we're actually cultivating about 7 of those acres. What you see here is probably about just a little over half of what we're cultivating, what you see in that picture. Basically, just these fields here and these hoop houses. And then we have some fields back here that we've been growing in. This is a little bit of an older picture. And we have a 3 more hoop houses over here. So our farm was started in 1998 by my brother John and his wife. They started by growing organic strawberries. In 2000, and their goal was to make a living off the land growing strawberries. In 2003, they had a bumper crop. This was their largest crop, and they had actually taken out a mortgage in order to make the investments that they needed to really, they realized they had to make more investment to really make it work. And so they did that and put in an acre and a half, and it was rained out. They basically just barely made their costs. So the question is, what do we do next? And so in order to survive, John went to his Elliott Coleman books, and he started our first winter CSA. So, you know, the strawberries, you know, the season finished in June. It finishes in June for us. And that's not time enough to get a summer garden in. But it is time enough to get a winter garden in. And so he started our first winter CSA with 12 subscribers. My family joined John in 2006. And we're now in our 17th winter season, growing produce through the winter. And so we started market gardening by growing winter produce, and just about I think it was about 5 years ago, we got into growing summer produce too. We kind of do things backwards at our place. But all right, latitude. What is latitude? I'm not talking about giving someone space here. Position. You know, when you look at maps, there are these lines that go up, across and up and down. Latitude are the ones going across. Now, latitude has significance to winter farming. Sorry, I don't know why. Okay. Latitude is important to winter farming because it determines your day length. Do you understand that? Okay. If you've studied geography a little bit in school, you remember. And it's interesting that, you know, the lower your latitude, the shorter your day length is year-round in general. The higher you go, the shorter your winters are and the longer your summers are. But, you know, as you move down, then you don't get those really long days. You get it just moderates things until you get to the equator and you have a 12-hour day year-round. Okay, so what's crucial for winter growing is that day length, not temperature, is the principal deciding factor in what can and cannot be grown through the winter. Okay? So it's day length that's the crucial factor. So where we are in Tennessee, we're on about the 35th parallel. And if you were to follow that parallel going east, it would enter into northern Africa in Morocco, and it would go through the northern part of Algeria and Tunisia, and then it heads out across the Mediterranean, right through the island of Crete and the island of Cyprus, and on into Syria. So we're talking about Mediterranean climate. What kind of things do they grow around the Mediterranean?
Olives,
yeah. Pardon? Figs, yeah. So theoretically, we can do those kinds of things where we are. The issue is that our temperatures are colder. We do have the day length, but we have colder temperatures. And so the idea is that if you can provide some protection, you can grow similar things. Okay? Now, I'm going to put a little caveat on this because I'm not totally convinced that, and I'm going to be talking about it more later too. I'm not totally convinced that that the very simple kind of protection we're doing would provide all you need, simply because although our average, you know, winter temperatures would how do I say it? Anyway, the issue is that we have these irregular deep freezes that come to us, and they're the issue, I think. And being, you know, where you wouldn't normally have them, but every once in a while they come and they would take out, you know, what you're trying to protect with just the simple protection I'm talking about. And I'm thinking particularly of trees. I haven't tried growing trees, you know, olives or lemons or, you know, things like that. I'm thinking it could be possible if you had something, some sort of a passive solar, you know, thing like water, barrels of water or something like that, that would kind of moderate those temperatures, but I haven't tried that yet. So, okay, timing is critical for winter growing. So we're talking about timing now. That's the next factor. As the days get shorter, we enter what winter growers have coined as the Persephone period, and that's when day length reaches 10 hours or less. And what we've noticed is that when day length reaches 10 hours or less, your plants pretty much stop growing. Okay, so that's kind of the critical issue there. So now, not every plant will actually stop growing. Some of the ones that I've seen that are most sensitive are ones like beets and chard. they really seem to, when we get to that 10 hours, they pretty much stop growing. Kale doesn't grow very much either. If it grows, it's very slow. It's interesting that collards seem to continue growing at a faster rate than kale. Spinach will continue to grow some, and lettuce will continue to grow some. But the issue is that all of them are slowing way down. Okay, so your days to maturity are just lengthening by big amounts. So there are, I didn't think to put this in there. You can just do a Google search on the internet for there are charts where you can find day length, for your latitude. You can find out what your latitude is, and then you can find these charts that will give you day length for your latitude. And so for us, this Persephone period is from about November 26 to January 16. So the challenge for the grower is to have your crops at maturity or almost at maturity as you enter in to the Persephone period. You got me? And so then you can be harvesting off of them, but you're not expecting them to be growing for you during that time. So I'll say here that, while we're talking about this, that the most difficult time period, we've found the most difficult time period to have crops ready for market is actually the months of March and April. Why is that? Because we can bring crops up to maturity, for harvest through December and January, and we're harvesting them right through even into February. But to have crops that are ready to harvest in March is very difficult because they had to be started back in that Persephone period, actually back towards the beginning of that Persephone period. And so they're just sitting in the ground basically as little seedlings, not doing hardly anything, and you've got to be babying them all through that period. It's just a very long time to have these little plants. yeah. So, all right. So, for example, with a, there are a lot of crops that have a normal days to maturity of 40 to 50 days. And so that's what we're looking at on this chart here. So if you were to plant one of those in early September, with that normal 40 to 50 days to maturity, you'll be harvesting it towards the end of October. If you plant that same plant in early October, you're going to be looking at harvesting it in January. If you plant that same plant in early November, you're going to be looking at harvesting it in late February. Okay, so you see what's happening here. This is another one where I've actually put on there the average number of the approximate number of days. So planting it in early September and harvesting it in the end of October is 60 days. So the days to maturity has lengthened, 10 or 20 days. But even in September. So it's in August that the days to maturity, towards the end of August, that it starts to go up. And so early September, it's already a few more days. So if you plant it in early October, we're looking at about 90 days to maturity. If you plant it in early November, we're looking at about 120 days to maturity. And what I want you to notice here, this is not a normal bell curve. We're used to seeing these bell curves that are symmetrical. This is not symmetrical. The days to maturity is climbing very steeply during the month of September. It starts climbing the end of August, and it climbs very steeply during the month of September, and then in October it starts to taper off, and by the time we get to November, it's kind of plateaued. As you enter that Persephone period, it plateaus. And then in January, it starts gradually coming down. It comes down, it doesn't come down as steep as it went up. So it just climbs very steeply in September, and then it goes down kind of gradually on the other side. Yeah, so you see, both if you're planting in early November or December, you have 120 days each, but in January, it's 105. February it's 90, March it's 60, so you're going down less steeply. Yes, you can. I'm specifically talking about very low technology, low cost ways that we can do it. You can add lights, you can add heat, and you can add lots of things, and you'll improve your results. But you know, we're looking at doing something very cheap and simple, which is what we can afford. Yeah, we'll be talking about covers in just a minute. Okay, so crop variety and selection. So obviously, growing this way without heat, we're not doing tomatoes or cucumbers or green beans. Is that clear? And if you think about the winter season versus the summer season, a key difference is that during the winter, most of your crops are going to be leaves and roots. Okay, and during the summer, the bulk of your summer crops are fruits. You know, speaking of fruits in a technical sense, considering, you know, green beans, fruits, it's the, you know, the fruiting part of the plant that you're eating. So, what do we actually grow? This slide has been a problem for me, but I'll try to read it. When I started growing in the winter, I was introduced to all kinds of things I'd never heard of before. There is a much wider variety of leaves and roots than I thought possible. So we grow all different kinds of lettuce. You know, there's romaine lettuce, there's leaf lettuce, there's mini heads, there's butter heads, there's oak leaf. There's just all different kinds of lettuce. And each of those different kinds tends to have a red and a green and sometimes a bronze in between. And I like growing all the different kinds so that we can, you know, it makes salads really interesting to have all these different colors and leaf textures and shapes. And chicory. Do you know what chicory is? That's really a family, kind of like lettuce is a family. Chicory are, dandelion is a chicory, okay? But then there's another very common chicory that most people, you know it, but you don't know it, and that's called radicchio. You know, when you buy a salad mix and it has these little pieces of purple in it, that's the radicchio. And what's characteristic about the chicories is they have a bitter flavor. They're good for seasoning a salad. They give a salad more body and flavor, but they're not everyone's favorite on their own. At least American palates aren't used to them. Europeans love them, but there are some chicories like escarole is very good in white bean soup, for example, and there are different things like that. Then there are other salad greens like mosh, arugula, cress. I said Persian cress here, but there's regular watercress too, and claytonia, or miner's lettuce, a different name for it, minutina, and several others. Do you all know what mosh is? Corn flour, corn salad, yeah. It's actually an American weed that went to Europe and got upscaled. And in France particularly, it's a really hot green. They eat a lot of it, actually. And it's a very nice one. It has a very, it's not like the chicories. It has a very mild, kind of a rich flavor. I like it very much. In fact, that very first picture, you saw a hand with a little green plant in it. That was mosh. And then miner's lettuce. That's also an American weed that went to Europe and kind of got upgraded. Yeah. And then there's a whole bunch of Asian greens, all different kinds of Asian greens. The mustard greens, there's just all different kinds of mustard greens in colors and leaf textures and shapes, and from yellow to green to red. And then there's the things like bok choy and tat soy and Tokyo Bacana, Yukina Savoy, Mizuna and Mebuna, and there's just all different kinds of a whole family of greens there. And those are, a lot of those can be grown on their own or grown in as baby greens in mixes, and they're very nice that way. There's Chinese cabbage, of course, too. By the way, we were looking at a study that was looking at nutrient values of different vegetables, and Chinese cabbage actually came out as number two. It's very high in just the study was looking at, I think, about 16 different items that, you could rate vegetables on, and they rated Chinese cabbage way up there. I had no idea. And then there's the brassica family. That includes cabbage, Brussels sprouts, kale, collards, broccoli, cauliflower, kohlrabi, all of that family. Do you all know what kohlrabi is? Okay, it's a big round stem. It's not a root, it's a stem. That it's really nice. It's a little bit like jicama for Latinos, if you're familiar with that. Okay, that's why I'm not seeing it very well. Okay. All right, then there are the roots. Things like beets and turnips and rutabagas, there are all different kinds of radishes. And then we grow carrots and more carrots. we love carrots. And what is really nice about winter carrots is that they are the sweetest carrots you'll find. There is something about the cold that sweetens them up and brings out the sugars in them. And you've never had a carrot until you've had a winter carrot. And what we found, you might want to take note of this, is that we have a window of about 10 days in late August. I'm talking about, like the last week or, into the third week through the end of August, is a window that we found to be right for seeding carrots for us. And when we seed carrots in that window, from about the second week in November through March, we are harvesting those carrots out of our field. They're almost mature on the in the second week of November, and then we're harvesting them fresh out of our field all winter long. If we get them in before that, they tend to get too big, and if we get them in after that, they don't quite get big enough. Now, I will say that this year, I'm doing an experiment. Last year, I tried growing some in a greenhouse, in a hoop house, and they did well, but they grew a lot faster than out in the field. And so I'm trying it again this year, and I actually started them 1 month late. And so we're going to see how that works. But I'm really pleased with how they're growing so far. Yes?
Where did you plant those?
The window. It's the last, right at the end of about the last 10 days of August.
Like 20th to the 30th?
Something like that, yeah.
Pardon?
You know, we have found that Bolero works very good for us. It's a storage carrot, and it works good, you know, storing it in the ground, and you know, as we harvest it. You might want to experiment with different ones. The Bolero is not the variety that Elliot Coleman up in Maine, you know, that's not his favorite. He uses, I think it's Napoli, is the one he likes. So I think it does make some difference where you are, which variety might do best for you. Yeah.
So you plant your carrots right in the ground, and then they're ready to harvest in the spring. You don't have hoop house over them or any covering?
We don't put a hoop house over them. We use a floating row cover over them, we'll just usually keep a single floating row cover layer over them all winter long. But when it's getting really cold, we'll put a second one on. Otherwise, they tend to get frozen shoulders. And the frozen shoulders are soft. They're just not so nice. You'd like to cut them off if you're going to eat them.
Floating row cover.
I'm going to talk more about that. Yeah. Yes. If it's going to be probably from the mid-teens or less, yes. That's a good question. Yeah. We like to keep the hoop house for lettuce, for chicory, for baby greens, for... I didn't get in this last group here. For Swiss chard... we have grown Swiss chard outside also, but it's nicer inside. Yes. Baby greens are, they can be anything just about. they can be anything from the brassica family and anything from the Asian green family, and a number of these European greens, even beet greens. The idea is that you're seeding these seeds very close together, and you let them grow to about this tall, and then you cut them, and so they're really good as salad or some of the brassicas and Asian greens. Some of those we do what we call a braising mix, that you just lightly braise. And yeah.
What about the stuff at the bottom? It says other
miscellaneous, like spinach, Swiss chard, celery, celeriac, fennel, artichoke, scallions, leeks, herbs, etc.
So you can grow those?
These are all things that we have grown through the winter. Now, I want to be clear on not all of these will actually grow all the way through the winter. For example, broccoli and cauliflower, the plants are hardy, but the heads that you're wanting to harvest are not hardy. And so we try to do those for November, maybe even the early part of December. We can keep them protected, but to try to take them all the way through the winter is a challenge. I've never tried to do that, actually. If they get frozen, you've lost them basically. So I mean, what we did one time, we accidentally, we thought we had a whole, 240-foot row of broccoli. We thought we had it covered. And, I mean, we did have it covered, but we had forgotten to put the sandbags on it. And the cover blew off in the night, and the temperature dropped. And so we came out in the morning to frozen broccoli. And so we cut it all immediately and put it in the freezer and gave it to our customers frozen. They got frozen broccoli that year. So, most of these other things you can actually, artichokes are very finicky. And, I put it there, but we have not had good success with them. When I say we've not had good success, it's like on a good year, we might get 50% of our artichokes all the way through. So we've actually stopped trying to grow them, for market at least. It's not really worth it for us. These are the globe artichokes, yeah. Now, Jerusalem artichokes are a totally different thing. And they, yeah, it's a root. And they are a very good winter crop. We have some of those that we harvested, I think, last February, wasn't it? Yeah, we dug them up in February, and that was great.
Do they need to be covered?
Jerusalem artichokes do not need to be covered. The other ones, like I said, they're very tender, and they need a lot of protection.
Yeah. The sunchokes.
You don't want to plant them where you might not want them permanently. So.
You don't want them to spread too much.
Yeah. It tastes exactly like artichoke.
So we might have they're, to
the roots. The roots look a little bit like ginger roots.
Yeah.
And they have a.
This is Jerusalem artichoke.
Yeah, Jerusalem artichoke.
Yeah, Edwin likes to pressure wash them.
April, I'd say, yeah.
April?
Yeah, as soon as the ground thaws. We actually did ours in, it was later, I think it was in May that we got them in.
I think they're the most forgiving thing you can do.
Yeah, they're very
you
forgiving.
Just throw them in, you'll get some.
I would recommend trying to get them in on the early side,
yeah.
But,
okay.
we didn't, and it worked. Okay, Going to the last part, protection. The last, we're looking at latitude, timing, variety selection, and then protection. So before we get further in protection, I want to clarify what we're talking about, because there are a lot of names that are kind of thrown around out there. Hoop house, high tunnel, cold frame, high hoops, low hoops, and greenhouse. The difference between all of these things that I've said and a greenhouse is that the greenhouse has a heat source. It has an internal source of heat that's heating it, whereas these other things are just protective structures that have no heat source inside them. Okay? Is that clear? So on our farm, we have one greenhouse that we just use in the spring to help get our tomatoes out so that we can have early tomatoes. But we don't use it for actually growing the winter produce that we're growing. Yes.
The greenhouse, you mean, has an artificial heat source?
Yes, yes. So when we're talking about protection, we're talking about two basic materials. One is plastic, and the other is floating row covers. The plastic we use is greenhouse plastic. It's 6 millimeter thick, and it usually comes with a 4-year guarantee, and it doesn't necessarily have to have what I call an anti-condensant film. But we like to buy plastic that has that. If you try to just use any plastic, chances are it's not going to hold up very long. It'll break down quickly. It might not let all the UV rays through that you want and need. I don't recommend trying to use some kind of plastic that's not a greenhouse plastic. The anti-condensate film allows the condensation that will collect on the underside of your plastic. You'll just get all these little water droplets in there, and they actually reduce the light that can come into your greenhouse. The anti-condensate film prevents those drops from beading. It makes them disperse on the plastic and just kind of run off. And that allows more light in. And so we prefer to use that kind of greenhouse film.
If you didn't have that type of plastic, is there some type of way of spraying that film on it?
I'm not sure. I mean, if you already have plastic and it doesn't have that, I wouldn't worry about it. You're going to have to replace your plastic in 4 or 5 years, and just get it later. Okay, the floating row cover. I'm going to have some pictures of floating row cover coming up, but basically it's a lightweight spun bonded fabric. It's not a woven fabric, and if you've ever used these dryer sheets in your dryer, that's what it is. So you just imagine that on a large scale, big sheets or rolls of it. Yes. No, Lowe's will not carry those things. There is a place online called FarmTech or GrowTech. It's two different names for the same company. You can buy greenhouse plastic through them. I think they do floating row cover too. Yeah. Another place that FarmTech or GrowTech, it's two different, if you go to either one, you'll end up basically on the same website. Another place that we prefer to get from is Deerfield Supplies. They're a Mennonite, and there are a bunch of catalogs of theirs up in the exhibit area. They're not online because they're Mennonites, but they tend to have cheaper prices than other places. They're in southern Kentucky, just north of Clarksville, Tennessee. They're a good place for a lot of different things. In addition to that, my nephew, Jonathan, he is selling the floating row cover. If you're interested, you can talk to him up here. Yes?
The plastic there, is that kind of the same type of plastic they use for like a hoop house?
Yes. Yeah, that's it is. That's what we're talking about. No, he's not selling plastic. He might start. he's starting to sell quite a few different things, but I'm not aware that he's selling plastic right now. All right, so talking about protection, you're acquainted with the concept of climate zones. The USDA has divided the country into climate zones, and so we live right here in climate zone 7. Basically, one layer of protection, that's one layer of either plastic or floating row cover, will move you about 1.5 climate zones south. Okay? So if you put two layers on, you're down in southern Florida, you can go on vacation and just crawl under your covers there and
yeah. So like we're in zone 5 in Nebraska. If we put 2 covers on, it would be enough.
That would bring you down into zone 8, kind of on the edge of 7 and 8. Yeah.
So that'd be good.
Yeah, I mean it that will
2 covers for light and 3 for heavy frost.
Right. I'm going to talk about how we do the covers in just a minute. So, yeah, you probably will not be able to, I mean, it is going to be different for you there than for us in Tennessee, but you can still do it. I mean, you're still not, I should go back. You know, Elliot Coleman he's in zone 5 and on the coast of Maine, so you know, he's growing through the winter, so you would be pretty similar to him. So we like Elliot Coleman's minimalist style, and what he recommends is using a single layer of plastic, you know, like in a hoop house, and then using floating row cover inside the hoop house. And so that's, we do a lot of that. But I will say that we grow a lot of our stuff outside. I mean, we grow almost all of our brassicas outside. And I mean, we've done as much as 1/2 acre of brassicas outside under floating row covers only. We do all our carrots outside. And we do beets outside. Yes.
What's the thickness on?
I thought I had that in here somewhere.
6 mils.
No, that's the plastic. Okay, the row covers we use are 1 ounce. It's a medium weight. They call it 1 ounce. What that means is 1 ounce per square yard, and it allows about 75% light penetration. Now I'll just tell you some brand names of different row covers. There's Agrabon. The name's slipping me on the. There's another common one that's used. Anyways, what we use is called GrowGuard. The factory is in Alabama, and that's what Jonathan is selling, is GrowGuard. So it's 1 ounce, 75% light penetration. You can get it all different weights. You can also use floating row cover, a very lightweight floating row cover in the summer to protect your plants from insects. So, or intense sun, yeah. Yeah, so that's a common organic grower practice.
Yes. Sandbags to hold them down?
Yes. Yeah.
But anything heavy would work.
We have tried lumber pipes, earth. You know, you can just heap earth on the edges. We've tried probably anything you can think about to hold down our floating row covers. Sandbags are the best thing by far. They're just so much easier to manage and use. If you're going to do it on any scale, I wouldn't recommend anything else.
We have lots of rocks.
Yeah, you can do that, but it, you know, if you have lots of, you need to have a sandbag that has about 15 pounds of sand in it. And so if you have something lighter than that, the wind will, I mean, even that 15 pounds, when the wind gets over 30 miles an hour, we start having trouble.
It's,
I'm going to show you some pictures here. Yeah. So, this is something very interesting that Elliot, tells about in his book, Winter Harvest Manual. And So he's talking about under a double layer. This means, you know, a single layer of plastic and then a floating row cover. Okay, so the outside temperature is 25. Under the floating row cover, it's 31 to 32. This is a nighttime temperature. You have to understand that in the hoop house and under the floating row covers, during the daytime, the temperatures are going to go way up. But at nighttime, under a single layer of plastic, you're only maybe 2 or 3 degrees warmer than outside. You're protected from the wind, which is very significant. Don't minimize that. The things, even, you know, without any floating row cover, things in a hoop house grow so much nicer than outside. That's just a fact, and it's really worth it to have that covering if you can do it. But the floating row cover adds a little more degrees of protection, so you have about 6 or 7 degrees of protection with the two layers at that kind of a high temperature. At 15 degrees, it's 27 or 28 under the floating row cover. That's giving you 12 or 13 degrees of protection. At 0 degrees, it's 25 under the floating row cover. You're getting 25 degrees of protection. You notice this, yeah. So it's not just that you only have X number of degrees of protection under the cover. As the temperatures get lower, the amount of protection increases. But I want you to notice also that your plants are freezing under there, okay? That's not a problem because we're growing plants that are cold tolerant, okay? And so you can come out in the morning and find all your crops are just frozen. It looks like you lost them. And it's very disheartening until about 11 o'clock in the morning, you go back and look at them and everything's fine and perked up. And the disconcerting thing is if it's on a harvest day, because you cannot harvest frozen vegetables. You know, unless, like I said, we harvested that broccoli and we put it straight in the freezer. But if you harvest it and let it thaw, it's no good. So there are a few things that you can harvest. It seems that scallions, for example, you can harvest them frozen, and they don't seem to be bothered. There are just a few things, but as a general rule, you don't want to harvest them frozen. That's a very good question, and yes, I would definitely try to do that as much as you can. Not just for the light, that is an important part of it, but also because your plants need airflow. Now, what's significant is that you do not want airflow when it's cold. And that's part of the reason for having the floating row cover over them. That's part of what it does is it reduces and minimizes that airflow. But when it's warm, your plants need airflow. I've noticed that if we leave our floating row covers on during the daytime, we start getting all kinds of disease problems. So you want to take them off as much as you can during the day. And then put them on at night. We talk about tucking our plants in for the night. Yeah.
So do you wait until
it's about freezing to do that? Or? I just do it at dusk. You know, as the light leaves the hoop house, try to put it on. Because the earlier, I mean, you don't want it to get. You want to try to capture the heat that you've gained during the day. You want to capture that under the row cover. For the night, if you can. Pardon? No, if it's a cold but sunny day, I'd go ahead and take it off. Now, I mean, it depends. If it's a very, very cold, like in the teens or less, you might want to leave it on even on a sunny day. Another thing is that you know, even outside where we're growing with a single row cover like our brassicas, we'll put a second row cover on when it's going to be very cold. And I've even done a third row cover, like for my broccoli, because I didn't want to lose it. and that works. But you always want to take that second and third row cover off during the daytime. You can leave one floating row cover on all the time. I've done that a lot, and that's fine. But the second or third floating row cover, if you leave those on all the time, you're actually going to have colder conditions underneath. And so they need to come off during the day and then go back on at night, only when it's needed at night. Just a few things about hoop houses. We prefer the Gothic shape, you know, this shape here, than the rounded shape. It's so much nicer to have straight sides, and then it'll shed snow a lot easier. We like to do roll up sides with a bit of a wind break there, and it also keeps small animals from entering the hoop house, rather than taking your roll up sides all the way down to the ground. So I think that's a significant thing. You don't want to crowd your hoop houses too close together. Just keep in mind shadow, you know, because the hoop house will cast a shadow. We like to, you can run your hoop houses north and south or east and west, but we prefer running our hoop houses north and south, because we prefer to have beds running north and south. And the reason for that is that as the sun comes up and goes across the sky, you get light on both sides of your bed. If your beds are running east and west, you have light on the south side, and the north side doesn't get light. And we've noticed that beds that run that way, we have more frost damage on the north side. So I think it's you know, we do actually have hoop houses that run both ways, but we run all of our beds north and south. It's just nicer to run them the whole length of the hoop house rather than across the hoop house. We do use movable hoop houses. I think our time's up, so I'm just going to go quick here. If you're interested in movable hoop houses, you can talk to me or my brother. We've tried a lot of different designs, and we have ideas on that. that's talking about the different designs. These are floating row covers in the field. So you can use quick hoops. Are you familiar with the concept of quick hoops?
No.
If you go down to your hardware store, you can get electric conduit in 10-foot lengths. You can get gray plastic, PVC, or you can get metal, EMT, conduit. You can use either one for these hoops. Do not use white PVC pipe, because it'll break down. The UV rays will break it down, but the gray PVC is UV resistant. If you buy the metal pipes, you have to get a bender to bend them. And Johnny's sells benders, and they have instructions on how to do that. So these hoops will cover two 30-inch beds. We like to grow in 30-inch beds. And we put a 1-foot walkway in between that seems very tight, but you get used to it after a while. So we have two beds in here with a 1-foot walkway, and the hoop is spanning 6 feet. Okay. And if you get a the idea is that you put your hoop down into the ground about roughly a foot on each side, okay? You drive it into the ground. And so you have about 8 feet of hoop on top of the ground. So if you buy a floating row cover that's 10 feet wide, that'll give you 1 foot on each side. So you have 8 feet of floating row cover covering the hoop, and then 1 foot on each side for your sandbag anchors or whatever you're going to use as an anchor. So you can see these are sandbags here. Something to think about when you're getting sandbags, make sure that they're UV resistant. You know, that we bought a bunch of sandbags where the stitching was not UV resistant. That was real disappointing. So you need to make sure that, you know, and I've had somebody tell me they tried using milk jugs. That doesn't work. And you know, like Walmart shopping bags, that's not going to work. You know, they're going to be done before your season's out. And, you know, you just don't, it's not worth messing around with things like that. If you're going to do these quick hoops on a large scale like we're doing here, we found that we could take a 30-foot wide piece of floating row cover, and we could cover four sets of hoops with it. Okay? And that made covering and uncovering a lot easier. I'll just tell you, you can grow a lot of stuff under a quick hoop, and it's very cheap. It's the cheapest entry level to winter growing. It's about 1/10 the cost of a greenhouse, but it is very labor intensive. It's a lot of work. But you can reduce that labor by covering four sets of hoops with one cover. What we found is that we did need to run sandbags down the center of it, because the wind would, you know, if we just tried to take it straight across all four sets, the wind would get underneath too much. So what we do is we'll put a sandbag on every single hoop, okay? So you have a sandbag on every single hoop. And then down the center, I just did a sandbag every other hoop. That wasn't so important, but it just needed to hold it down. Yes?
How far apart are your hoops?
They have that 1 foot walkway in between them also.
How far between the hoops?
Oh, it's about 5 feet.
5 feet?
Yeah. And you don't want to end up getting your hoops more than 6 feet apart, because then your arch is not as steep, and we've had snow collapse them, especially the plastic hoops. So if you're interested in doing the hoops, I'd encourage you to talk to me, because there are a number of little details I can't, you know, I don't have time to say, but the little touches that make it a lot easier and more effective. Normally you'd want to pull the row cover off to harvest, but on cold, windy days, you don't want to do that. And I've crawled down the hoop house, you know, harvesting and dragging a box behind me to put stuff in. One person can do it. I have done it by myself, but it takes longer than twice as, I mean, you know, a second person can make it less than half the time. You know, it's worth it to have two people working on it.
Snow conditions?
On these quick hoops? I don't know. You know, Elliot Coleman uses them, and he gets a lot of snow. Like I said, we had them spaced a little further than 6 feet apart, and we had some collapse. So, and that was with like maybe an inch and a half of wet snow. So in summary, we can grow our own fresh local produce through the winter. The basic technology is very simple and low cost. When Adam and Eve sinned, they saw that they were naked, and then God clothed them with a covering of skin taken from a lamb that represented his righteousness. That covering enabled them to grow in the winter of sin that had settled on the earth. I really like this verse in Isaiah 61. I will greatly rejoice in the Lord. My soul shall exult. For he has clothed me with garments of salvation. He has covered me with the robe of righteousness. For as the earth brings forth its sprouts, and as a garden causes what is sown in it to sprout up, so the Lord God will cause righteousness and praise to sprout up before all the nations. This is one way we can reclaim the waste places, you know, the waste seasons. we have seasons that are waste also. And, you know, instead of using technology to preserve food for the winter, we can actually use technology to grow food so we can have fresh food. And I'll tell you, we have reduced our canning by having fresh food. We basically grow canned tomatoes and applesauce and don't do hardly any other canning because we have all this fresh stuff available all winter long.
This media was brought to you by Audioverse, a website dedicated to spreading God's word through free sermon audio and much more. If you would like to know more about Audioverse, or if you would like to listen to more sermons, please visit www.audioverse.org.